to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. We're talking with Congressman Ben McAdams, the OG of the coronavirus. I mean, he was getting tested and he was laid up before anyone else was. That'll be the last joke I'll make about it because it is a serious thing. But he did contract, suffer through and come out the other side of the coronavirus. Plus, he contracted and suffered through the election process to be able to be elected and be back in Washington, D.C. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Richie. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. You know, it's not often that we have politicians, and I'm air quoting, on the Cultural Hall with us. But I'm excited to be able to get to know you a little bit and to be able to get to know what's going back in Washington, how your faith kind of interacts with what you do, and anything else that we may pick up along the way. First of all, sir, knowing that you are a survivor of Corona, how are you feeling? And talk to us about that experience.
Sure. You know, I actually am feeling great right now. And some of that is relative. I felt so awful just a few weeks ago. But now I feel great. I got on the treadmill this morning for an hour and got in a workout, and I feel really good. So it happened for me. I was in D.C. on March 13th. We had a late night vote that was at 2 a.m. And then I had a 6 a.m. flight back to Utah. Oh. So that night I slept like 2 hours, didn't get great sleep. I flew back to Utah, came home, was home all day. And by Saturday night, so this would have been March 14th, I started feeling kind of run down. I thought, oh, it's probably just because I haven't slept much.
Sure, late night flight, this early morning. Yeah. And anyone who has to fly from Washington, D.C. or even be in Washington, D.C., there's a little bit of feeling of ick.
Exactly. You know what I'm talking about. So I'm like, oh, I'm just going to go to bed and sleep it off. And so I did. And I woke up the next morning and I still just didn't feel good. I felt it wasn't terrible, to be honest. It was a little bit achy. I had a temperature of about 100 degrees, which doctors say is, you know, that can happen. Just, you know, that's not too big, nothing to worry about.
Right.
I did call my doctor because we were just starting to hear about the coronavirus. I think that the NBA had been canceled that week. And you know, I don't remember if they'd canceled schools yet. I think they had just said they were going to shut down schools. So it was right on the at the beginning of it. And I called my doctor. I was a little bit worried. And he said, look, your symptoms, you know, certainly sound a little bit troubling, but it could be any of a number of things.
Right.
Probably not the coronavirus, but you should stay home and be careful not to infect anyone else. But you don't justify a test. We didn't have very many tests at that time.
And so he said, like, you had to prove yourself worthy of a test. And they're like, oh, no, turn away. You are not test worthy.
Yeah. So I got turned away. And he said, let me know if it gets worse. So, you know, Sunday was okay. Monday actually felt decent. I got on the treadmill again on Monday morning. And after that, I just crashed. I plowed through. I was working from home, doing a lot of conference calls and stuff from home. Mm-hmm. But by Monday night, I felt pretty run down. And I felt it kind of move into my lungs. It felt like my chest was tight. Felt like I had a belt tightened up around my chest. Oh. So I could breathe, but couldn't take a deep breath. I could, and I just felt pretty run down. So I had a kind of a restful night on Monday night. I woke up on Tuesday morning, and I called my doctor and described these new symptoms that had developed. And he said, yeah, I think you now meet the criteria for at least getting tested, you know?
Yeah.
So I went in and got tested on that Tuesday. And my test came back Wednesday afternoon, said I was positive.
Right.
And very positive, actually. So
extremely A-plus in COVID. Yeah. You have got it bad.
I'm an optimistic person. So, you know, maybe that was part of it.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, continue to stay home. Don't go out of the house. Don't infect anybody. Be careful, which is what I was already doing anyway.
Yeah.
I did continue to work from home and that, and I probably pushed myself pretty too hard that week.
Yeah.
So by Friday evening, I was exhausted and I laid down in bed and was just trying to, just felt like garbage and wanted to rest and that. And I laid down and then I got up about 7 o'clock on Friday evening. I got up and I was walking across my bedroom and I couldn't make it across the bedroom before I had to stop and lean on the dresser. I was out of breath, panting.
Oh my
And
gosh.
I just had to catch my breath. And so I went back down and laid down. I called my doctor and he said, that's really a bad sign. You need to go to the hospital right now.
Oh, wow.
And so I packed up a couple of things and went to the hospital. And the first thing they did was check my blood oxygen level. Typically, you know, a healthy person, it's around 100. Anywhere from 95 to 100 is normal for a blood oxygen. Low 90s is concerning, something to watch. If you're sick, you might be in the low 90s. Mine was in the low 80s.
Oh my gosh.
When I checked in. And so they said, yeah, we're going to put you on oxygen. We're going to watch you overnight and see how it goes. And, you know, it just, and one night became eight nights. So I spent eight nights in the hospital.
Just oh my gosh.
Never, anytime I took that, I was never on a respirator, fortunately, but yeah. Anytime I took that oxygen hose out of my nose, my levels would tank. I'd get lightheaded. I'd, you know, start, I couldn't breathe. And so it was pretty scary. And I just felt like, it just felt awful for 8 days in the hospital. And toward the end of it, about 16 days in, after first developing symptoms, I started feeling better. They discharged me. They sent me home. And I was quarantined to a spare basement here at home. Felt like I had, like, made my wife mad or something. Yeah. And I had to sleep downstairs.
Well, we know what you did. We know what you did.
Yeah. They'd leave cold food outside of my room that I could eat, leftovers.
There's a code, like a knock code on the door. You know, a couple knocks means it's a drink, and four knocks means it's food. Jeez.
So finally I got better, and now I'm feeling great now. Feeling really good.
So along with that, like being sort of the original, you know, I make that joke about it, but coming through this when not very much is known, you end up, you know, finally being test worthy and then being able to go to the hospital. I would think that there's a tremendous amount of apprehension on your end with your family. I mean, you've got wife and kids that you live with. And so it's like, help me, but really don't help me because I don't want you to get this. But then also going to the hospital, like that was probably right around they were starting to establish protocols. So you'd come in and it, like I've joked around about this as well, but I would think it would almost need to be that you'd yell unclean as you're making your way into the hospital so that, you know, that people very much knew what was going on.
Yes, they actually had a whole setup that it probably just started the day before I went in, but they had a big signage that said Corona, COVID-19, this way. They had these big tents with people in all the gear and protective gear and that. So you can't even go in the front door of the hospital. You went to this side thing and they checked you in. I had called ahead. My doctor told them I was coming. So they said, okay. And they escorted me through this back way and had me put on a mask and escorted me through the back way and put me right in a room and isolated me. And then anytime anybody came in to check on me, they had the full garb on. And before they'd leave, they'd rip it all off, take off their gloves, throw it away just to, you know, take extra precautions. And it was, it was pretty wild. I, you know, no visitors. So I would FaceTime my family and talk to them that way. And I shouldn't comment. So I've got this beard that I've never had in my life.
Uh-huh.
Beard started.
Yeah.
8 days laying in a hospital bed, no energy to shave. You know, I could barely get up to go to the bathroom when I needed to. So this is my hospital stay beard. I'm going to shave it eventually.
No. Here's the deal. I was just going to say it's very trendy right now to keep the Corona beard. There's actually a hashtag Corona beard that you can see online. And for you in particular, because I've heard many people reference you as the boy congressman, like it makes you look nice and, you know, mature and distinguished. And I say stick with it.
All right. I'll keep it for a little while. I thought I got past the itchy phase, but it's itchy again.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'll keep it for a while.
I mean, the biggest question is does your wife like it, or is she going to make you sleep in the spare basement again?
Yeah, she's tolerating
okay,
it.
Okay.
I'm not sleeping in the spare bedroom.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, nice. Were you ever scared for your life in all that?
You know, I maybe should have been. Fortunately, I wasn't on a ventilator. They were worried. They were doing lung x-rays and there were some spots on my lungs that they were worried about and, you know, hoping it wouldn't, watching it for it to turn into viral pneumonia, when it would have been really scary.
Right.
So there were a couple of days where I just felt awful. And, you know, I called my wife and I just said, I don't have the energy to carry on a conversation. So there was a couple of days that I felt bad for all 16 of it, but there were a couple of days where it was just the worst and no energy. I couldn't eat. I didn't have an appetite. In fact, So I lost 13 pounds while I was in the hospital.
That's a way to do it.
It's a diet plan. Not one I'd recommend, but a good way to lose weight.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And then also, like I remember you talk about this time in the hospital, but you were on CNN and I happened to be watching it and I messaged you directly afterwards because I was like, oh my gosh. You need to get to the hospital. And I don't know if you've had a chance to see that video or other videos that you did before you went to the hospital. And I don't mean this, you know, in any sort of disrespectful way, but I was just like, he's in a bad way. I hope that he, you know, takes care of himself.
I think it was a couple hours after that CNN interview that I went to the hospital. Oh. There were people who called my doctor to tell them that I needed to go to the hospital. And so he had already heard from viewers of CNN and that. And I actually felt okay at the time, but it was a couple hours after that I really crashed. And so
if I can find a link to that, I'll post it at theculturalhall.com. You can see Representative McAdams as it's just like, okay, man, you need to be looked after a little bit.
Yeah. And you know, I was getting all these messages when I was in the hospital, all these messages of people on social media, just reaching out and wishing me well and that. So as I was leaving the hospital, I recorded just a selfie video saying that I'm better. I'm leaving the hospital. I look back at that video and I looked like I had, you know, I looked bad.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you saw that.
And all this to say, it's serious business. And so now in the highly divisive other part of this, before we get to know you a little bit more, like, we should be staying home. This is serious business. Like, all of these groups and factions now that are coming forth, and it's like, let us break free, and we deserve the right to get our nails done and our hair cut and all this stuff, which I agree with. But there is the whole other element of being safe, and I think that you have a unique perspective because you survived it.
Yeah, so I'm in the category that, you know, they say that I'm a low-risk category. I'm 45 years old, I'm healthy, I don't have any other health conditions, I exercise and I take vitamins, you know?
Yeah.
So, and it hit me really, really hard. And so I would just say, you don't know how hard it's going to hit you, and take the precautions. And, you know, I would say, if not for yourself, think about those people who you might infect. So I'll tell you, the one person who stuck in my mind that I was so worried about, there's a woman in our ward. Mm-hmm. She's so sweet. She's 105 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And so a week before I got sick, I, you know, had gone up and given her a hug and talked to her. And I thought, you know, and so the first thing I asked my doctor is, how far before exhibiting symptoms was I contagious? And they said 48 hours. And I'll just tell you the sigh of relief I had knowing that I hadn't infected this 105-year-old lady in our ward. You don't want to come down with this, you know, even if you feel that you don't need to take the precautions for yourself, which you should, mm-hmm. let me say that, but you don't want to have on your shoulders that you're treating this lightly and not taking it seriously is the reason that your grandmother or, you know, neighbor or somebody came down with it and they did have a serious case. So, because you are, what they do say is the period that you are most contagious is about 48 hours before you show symptoms. So you can, without knowing, infect a loved one, someone you care about, and they can come down with it. And then the other thing is just, we're part of a community here. Yeah. I'm optimistic. Utah has reasons to be optimistic. The numbers are looking good for us. It looks like we have flattened the curve, that our hospital system will be able to have the capacity to treat this. That doesn't mean we can take our foot off the brake and go back to normal. You know, I think there are people who are really suffering, and we're going to be looking at, and our governor really is the one making these decisions, but he's going to be looking at what sectors of the economy can we start opening up? Can we get people back to work? But if you have an office job, a job where you can work from home, just because, you know, that your neighbor is going in to work construction, which is one of the sectors I think we may be able to open up sooner rather than later, you should still stay home. You know, let's everybody do our part. Be as cautious as you can be as conservative as you can be with this. And let's each of us do our part for the sake of the community. If what we don't want is to open back up and everybody rushes and starts going to big community gatherings and concerts and everything, and then it spreads and it catches us again and we have to shut it down and we're talking about flattening the curve again. So take it seriously, be as careful as you can be.
Well, and there's a whole other component, like as we record this, as we chat, you know, Georgia has just essentially said, yeah, cool advice, guys. We're going to go ahead and do what we'd like to do. That impacts and can have an impact on the entire nation and the entire world as well. It's not just Georgia. Like, they're part of a greater and bigger community. As far as the, you know, the financial impact of everything, I mean, I know that you have been a part of a vote that has, you know, given money a couple of times now to people in the nation. Like, I know you're no sort of a forecaster or prognosticator, but we're in for a little bit of a bad way as far as that goes, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the analogy, so we've pumped some money into the economy right now. And what we're trying to do is, you know, the analogy is that the economy, like the coronavirus patient, really is really sick right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it's right to call it even a stimulus. We're not stimulating the economy. There is no economy right now to stimulate.
Yeah.
We have put the economy and the American workforce on a ventilator, essentially. So mm-hmm. What we're trying to do with these bills is we're trying to breathe for the economy, since it can't breathe for itself. And so we passed some bills. The big one was the CARES Act. And one of the key components of the CARES Act is this payroll protection program that gives money to forgivable loans to small businesses. If a small business takes this loan and uses the overwhelming majority of those funds to pay their employees, to keep their employees on payroll, then the loan will be forgiven. And so the goal there is really to keep money flowing, so hardworking Utah families have a paycheck, can pay their rent, can put food on the table. And what you want is, when we are ready to start opening, that business still is alive and the employees are connected to the business and they can open up, they can turn on the lights quickly, rather than, you know, now looking for office space, taking care of their bankruptcy filing, posting hiring notices and that. If we do that, then the recovery is going to be bad. What you want is to be able to, as we gradually turn on the economy and we say we're ready now for hair salons to open, they can flip the switch and beyond.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're doing right now, is really keeping the economy on a ventilator, keeping it alive until it can start breathing on its own.
So then, moving into maybe a little bit of political side of this, and then also getting to know you a little bit more, you have this letter D that's attached to your name.
Yeah.
It stands for Democrat. I would think that a lot of people in Utah, or maybe even within the church, wouldn't know what that D stands for. And you may contend differently, and I want to get into that a little bit. But why does there seem to be so much, this is sort of a softball, but also a very serious question. Why does there seem to be so much fighting between the two different parties, and it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, as we just try and take better care of, the nation and its people and getting back on the road to all this? Why isn't it just like, no, this is automatic. I know these things are passing without anyone voting against it. Which is great, but they're also not just like, yeah, done, sign, let's go. There's discussion around it. And so from your vantage, why are we doing that?
For me, the partisanship is nauseating. And I'm, you know, you have to affiliate with a party to run for office. But I don't think anybody in elected office should do this. You should never put party ahead of the people you serve, the country that you serve. It may indicate a starting point for negotiations, some, you know, philosophical approach to negotiations. But at the end of the day, you know, the perspective that I bring to Congress is probably the perspective that I formed. I was the mayor of Salt Lake County. And that local government perspective is one of really pragmatism and problem solving first. When you're a mayor, you don't have the luxury of shutting down the government because you can't agree with the council on the budget and not plowing snow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have a mutiny overnight if the snow didn't get plowed, if the police force was laid off and couldn't work, or, you know, fire department was shut down. So there's really just a sense of immediacy and pragmatism to the job, where, sure, I'm going to have a perspective. When I was mayor of Salt Lake County, I had priorities and perspectives, but I got to sit down with people who disagree with me. And oftentimes in that regard, the disagreements weren't Republican or Democrat. They were sometimes regional, sometimes, you know, different priorities that people had, but they broke down. We had 9 council members, 5 Republicans, 4 Democrats. So I had a Republican council that I worked with. And, you had 9 different opinions on that council.
Right.
You didn't have 2. And, we had to sit down and forge a consensus, and we did. And, you know, that doesn't mean there weren't disagreements or arm wrestling a little bit on stuff. But at the end of the day, we knew that there was a deadline and we had to have an agreement. And that's what frustrates me about Washington. It feels like they've lost that sense. And what they're looking at is, I'm going to point the finger at both sides, including the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So many people in Washington are just looking for the next election. What's going to give us a leg up in the next election? Can we, you know, we don't want to give the other side credit for anything. We want to make sure that the other side gets blamed for this or that. And that really, I think, has really contaminated the process.
Yeah.
And that's what you're seeing a lot of. And, you know, with an exception being, I think over the last month, as we've been dealing with the coronavirus, I think people have been more willing to put aside partisanship and to make a deal, which is encouraging. Look, you've seen with the legislation we've passed related to coronavirus. disagreement. And depending on what news source you'll watch, that, you know, if you're watching MSNBC, the Republicans are risking the safety of the country. If you're watching Fox News, it's the Democrats who don't care about the economy and everybody blaming each other. I'm going to say, taking cable news aside, it's natural to have different priorities and perspectives in this. You know, Democrats were focusing on making sure that this PPP program, what you saw with the PPP is it was a good and important program. This is the payroll protection program I talked about, the ventilator. The people who were quickest to jump in line for that were those people who were sophisticated operations, who had a relationship with their bank that was ongoing, that they were, you know, constantly doing finances and refinances, and they were larger, more established institutions. So who was at the back of the line? Whereas your dry cleaner, your nail salon, your, you know, some of those really small businesses that they were digging out their tax returns, and they didn't have an accountant to help them through the application process. And maybe the bank that they work with isn't Chase Manhattan Bank. It is small corner bank that, you know, credit union, University of Utah Credit Union or something small like that. And so their bank maybe took a week to figure it out, and they took a week to figure out how to put in the application. By the time they got the application in, the money was gone.
Right.
Right. So Democrats are saying, you had Republicans saying, and I'm actually see both sides of this, so I'm not pointing fingers at either side. The Republicans are saying, we need to put more money into the PPP, and we need to do it already because businesses are suffering. I think that's I tend to agree with that point of view. Democrats saying, not so fast. We want to make sure that the money's not gobbled up again by the Shake Shacks and the Ruth's Chris steakhouses and the Harvards. We want to make sure that there's money left for the little guy, you know, the minority-owned business, the mom-and-pop operation that isn't quite as sophisticated. How do we make sure that money makes it to the back of the line and isn't just gobbled up at the front of the line?
Right.
And so that was kind of the difference there. And some jockeying, and ultimately both sides had to give a little bit of compromise, and they did. And, you know, unfortunately it went, this is how Washington does it. You know, you wait until the deadline and then give it another week, and then they strike a deal.
But good. So you guys are all aware that you do that too. Cause I feel like as a general public, we're just like, come on, they said they were, another week. Okay. Yeah. No, go ahead. Take a week, guys. That's fine. That's fine.
That's really frustrating to me. But we did. We went in. Actually, it was on Thursday. I don't know when you're going to air this. So
sure.
A few days ago, I just got back from Washington yesterday. We were there, voted it just a few days ago. Put some more money into the PPP program, and you know, and it's back up. Undoubtedly, it's going to run out of funds.
Right.
And we're going to be right back where we were in a couple weeks. You know, but I think I would differentiate philosophical differences in a negotiation. That's going to happen. That's healthy. That's part of a democracy.
Uh-huh.
It can be frustrating when you're that small business waiting for the funding. We shouldn't blow past deadlines and stress people out even more. But, you know, I think that got worked out later than it should have, and a lot more drama than we should have had, but it got worked out. And I think that's healthy. That's different than what I think is starting to rear its head again, is just there's an election in November. Both sides figuring out how to blame each other. That makes my stomach churn. It nauseates me. And I would hope that we can stick with some of the lessons we've learned over the last month of, we got to, you know, like the mayors, we got to make a deal. We got to get this done. It's not going to wait. We can't wait till the next election. The businesses aren't going to be here, and make a deal. And I think we've done that over the last month. I hope we can continue to do that. Maybe people have gotten a taste for it.
For sure. Let's take a break real quick. And when we come back, I want to get to know why that young Benny McAdams from West Bountiful, Utah, how he decided, man, Congress is a thing I want to do. Being a mayor is a thing I want to do. So we'll get to know a little bit more about you coming back in the second block of the Cultural Hall. Hey, it's me, Richie T. I found myself with a little bit more time on my hands, and maybe you're finding yourself in that same position. Well, allow me to introduce you to Best Podcast Consultant in Utah. I don't have the domain. And really, I can do this wherever because I'm doing most of the classes virtually. But if you would like to reach out to me, probably the simplest way is if you just do contact@theculturalhall.com, or you can find me online, richietstedman.com. You can check that out. I would love to help you if you are already established in a podcast, or you're thinking, you know what, I've got this downtime. It's a passion project. I've always wanted to do it. You can reach out to me. You can do contact@theculturalhall.com or find me on any social media at Richie T. Stedman.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Here in the second block of the Cultural Hall, if you have not become a Patreon saint of the Cultural Hall, I encourage you to do so. You go to patreon.com/thecultural hall. And you can make donations to be able to help the Cultural Hall continue on. Things like pay for Zoom, which is how we're able to do this interview with Congressman Ben McAdams. Things like the microphone, which I'm speaking into. Plus, if you become a Patreon saint, you get to be a part of that secret but not sacred Facebook group where everyone's chatting about the episodes as they get published. Ben, were you in fact a Benny at any point?
Benji.
Oh, you were a Benji. Cute. Yeah. Why not Benji? That's great. Why not keep Benji?
I don't know. I graduated from high school, came home from my mission, and became Ben.
Where did you serve a mission?
Brazil.
Okay.
I was in the São Paulo East Mission in Brazil.
Is that now, there have been some temples that have been added, but there's always kind of been a temple in São Paulo, right?
Yeah. Yeah, nice. There is a temple right there. It wasn't in my mission, but it's so dense and such a big city that we actually could go to the temple, had permission to go like once a quarter or something.
Oh, cool. What was the mission experience like for you?
I loved it. I mean, it was life-changing for me, you know, just not only spiritually, but also I think it's where I found myself. You know, I was this kid from West Bountiful, Utah that got out there on a mission and realized I could do anything I wanted to do. I could, you know, if I would dedicate myself to it and work hard, I could do anything I wanted to do. And I worked hard and really learned a lot about myself and came back. You know, I, for example, I did a quarter of college before I left and I was getting my B's and came back and started getting A's in college and just really learned to apply myself. Life-changing experience.
Where'd you go to school before you went on the mission?
I went to Weber State before.
Okay.
And then came back and graduated from the U. Well, I came back and finished my associate's degree at Weber and then went to the U.
Nice.
I'll also say missions where I became a Democrat.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, then we have to get into that a little bit. Why? Yeah. So were you a conservative young Elder McAdams when you left and you came back that flaming liberal that seats before me?
I was probably uninformed and apathetic before I left. Right. But I just saw in Brazil a few things. How my mom was a school teacher. My parents actually got divorced while I was on my mission.
Oh. But
for the most part, my mom raised us as a single parent on a school teacher salary. But she really instilled in us the value of learning and reading and education. And then I saw in Brazil what a differentiator that was for people who had access to a good education, what that meant to them. Mm. And then I just saw the differences between, you know, how wealth, you know, the wealth disparity in Brazil is unlike anything I had ever seen here in the U.S. So how wealth created opportunities and poverty closed doors, and really became a believer that there was a role for government. I think a limited role. I consider myself a conservative Democrat.
Yeah.
Believe in limited government, but I think there's a role for government to help to open doors and create a level playing field for people like, I think, myself, who, you know, I was probably wealthy by Brazil standards, but by U.S. standards, you know, there were a lot of doors that were probably closed to me, except for the fact that I was able to get Pell Grants and student loans to low interest student loans to go to school and, you know, other opportunities that were made available to me that wouldn't have otherwise been available. And I think I was able to use those opportunities to make myself better and improve my situation for myself and my family.
So while you were serving, was it like, I'm going to make the world a better place and one day I'm going to be the mayor of this town? And then I'm going
to. So I say it's where I became a Democrat. I don't think I had made the logical connection that I'm a Democrat and I'm going to run for office someday. I just I saw how as a missionary, we would do things like English language classes or, you know, help either member families or new member families get connected to food, just basic things that they would have that would stabilize them, and then see them just prosper over time. And having access to their kids, access to those language classes and learning and seeing a new world that they could aspire to. And companions of mine who grew up in utter poverty and went on the mission, and what that meant. I think spiritually it's important for them. I don't want to dismiss that. But also from a worldly sense, learning English because you had a companion who spoke English, and learning to read because there was such rigor to study and having that discipline just made such a difference in the lives of my Brazilian companions that they would then finish their missions. Or, you know, it wasn't until a decade later that I saw them finish their mission and that transformation. But you'd see people who had served the mission and come home, and just what a transformational force it had been in their life. And I came back thinking, not only can we do things to help create opportunities and lift people out of poverty, but that I gained satisfaction out of doing that. And I wanted to come back and do something that where I could give back and I could be part of helping people to improve their lives. So my sisters became social workers, and I think and therapists, right? Mm-hmm. And I probably a similar ethic. Maybe it's from our childhood and partially from our mission, but I felt like I wanted to do that. I wanted to help and give back, but that I could do it in a way through public service.
Why do you think that more members of the church aren't Democrats? I'm going to pull that pin and then just let that grenade go and let you...
You know, I think there are...
Because there are some, but certainly when we see a member of the church on a state or national level, it is very rare that we see the D attached to them.
So I didn't know this until I got elected to Congress, but I am the only active member of the church who's a Democrat in the United States Congress, House or Senate.
Huh.
And so it is a little bit lonely.
Yeah, so that. So why are you the only one? Especially given the similar principles that the church, if we can say the organization of the church, I call that the church, that the church has, that has the similarities with Democrats.
I think there's neither party has a monopoly on good principles, I think, or good ideas and good people. There are good people in both parties. There are bad people, I think, in both parties. There are bad ideas in both parties.
I would agree with that.
To some extent. Okay. I think philosophically, I think maybe it's because as members of the church, in our religious life, we don't have the sense that there is, we do believe, right? There is one true church.
Right.
And maybe it's that when you take that outside of the church context and you apply it to politics, maybe we're looking for that one true political party.
Interesting.
And I don't think that's right. I think, you know, Joseph Smith said, we look for truth. I'm bungling the quote, but we look for truth and knowledge from
wherever we can find it. Yeah.
And I think we should consciously differentiate between the gospel, where we believe there is one truth and there's one true church, and out in the world, you know, we don't, you know, and you look at our religious leaders, we believe in sustaining and supporting our religious leaders. We don't believe in sustaining and unquestionably supporting our political leaders. Actually, that system that our founders created is one where we do second guess and question and challenge our political leaders in a way that we don't do with our religious leaders. And so for me, I think some of it is recognizing that those systems are different, and how we interact as individuals with our religious hierarchy and our political hierarchy are fundamentally different. So maybe it's just we approach that as we approach our political system similar to how we approach our religious system. And I don't think we should. Mm. You know, some of it is, I think there are areas where the Democratic Party has gone against some of the values and principles of the church, but I would say the same is true for the Republican Party.
Right.
And recognizing again, there's good and bad in both parties. There are good leaders and bad leaders in both parties, and find good and look for good wherever you can have it. And I would say vote for people who seem to align with your values. I am not a believer in subscribing part and parcel to any political party. And my ballot, I've never voted a straight ticket. straight Democrat, straight Republican. I look for the people and who I think is good and qualified to serve. And then I'll vote for Republicans. I think we should do that as individuals. We should look for good wherever we can find it, Republican or Democrat, and vote for good people.
Oh, and similar maybe to Joseph Smith, if we can't find anyone that we want to vote for, we just do it ourselves and start our own party. Maybe not that far. I'm just teasing.
Yeah. there you go.
No, but it is an interesting thing when you consider sort of the church and aligning itself with a party. And I've often wondered, like, if the Democratic Party maybe took a different stance on abortion or something like that, if then we would see the mainstream of the church flux if it hangs on one issue. And, you know, I don't know that we can know except for each individual.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, like I said, I don't think, I wouldn't expect anybody to take everything in the Democratic Party platform or the Republican Party platform and say, I have to mindlessly follow that. Yeah. I'm pro-life, right? Mm-hmm. But the church's position on on abortion is thoughtful. It's sensitive. It recognizes that in cases of endangerment to the life of the mother, incest and rape, that that decision isn't black and white. It really is one that the woman should approach prayerfully and thoughtfully and in consultation with people she trusts. And that's my position. And it probably makes me, you know, that's not the Republican Party position. It's also not the Democratic Party position.
Right.
But I think it's in today's world, oftentimes we are looking for the soundbite. And that's true in our politics. It's true, I think, in our shopping habits, right? You look for that quick thing. You don't have time to research everything you buy, and people oftentimes don't have time to research every vote they cast. And so they look for those sound bites and those things where they can black and white, yes or no. And most of our issues aren't that simple.
Well, and speaking of that, I mean, you ran and won in probably, if not the hardest in the entire nation, one of the hardest areas in the nation to be a Democrat and win out of Utah, first of all, just in general out of Utah, but in the 4th district in the state of Utah. I mean, highly contested down to like the single last vote. I don't think it was exactly that close, but there was a recount, as I understand.
We avoided a recount by, I think, 5 votes.
Yeah, insane. The value of the particular votes in your district. And I would suppose that you're going to try and do that again. That sounds exhausting. Why would you do that?
Well, I'm going to try and win on election day. That's my goal this time, is to win and to not have it drag out for 3 weeks. It wasn't a recount, but remember, it took so long to count the votes because it was so close. I won by 1/4 of 1% was the margin. It was a really close race. And you're right. It is actually, it is the most Republican district held by a Democrat in the country. And, I think the reason I win is because people know that I'm not going to be succumb to pressure from Republican Party, Democratic Party. I'm going to be independent for the most part. I'm going to represent people on my district and call it as I see it and do what I think is right. And I think that now that I've been there for 1.5 years and people have seen me in action, I think people have seen my independence and willingness to go against my own party when I think it's appropriate and stand, make tough decisions to stand for what I believe in. And so I'm running again because I do believe in public service. I do believe that good people can make a difference, and I want to be part of that. And there's some issues for me that are really important that I continue to work on. Expanding access to education is a key one for me. You know, my mother was a school teacher. I talked about that. Helping people receive redemption and turn their lives around. As mayor, I worked really hard on expanding options for treatment for people who have a substance addiction. And instead of just putting them in jail and locking them up and throwing away the key, which, by the way, is really, really expensive. I'm also a fiscal conservative. I care about balance and budget, balanced budgets and limiting government spending. And
I'm sorry, what are these balanced budgets and limited budget, budget spending? I think you're the first person that I've ever talked to that works in Washington, D.C. that knows about them. Or so
well,
it seems.
We're going to have a day of reckoning, and it's going to be painful. And it's going to be less painful the sooner we take it seriously and get to that. But I was talking about criminal justice, and it's really expensive to incarcerate people. And you know what's less expensive? Putting them in a drug treatment program and helping them get a job. And as mayor, I saw that the lives that were changed because we helped people rather than locked them up. And that's something I'm really passionate about that I want to continue to work on. And so I guess I'm running again because I've seen, like it on my mission, I've now seen in my public service people whose lives are better because I was able to work. And you don't do anything alone in public service, but I often look at work that I've done with Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Speaker Greg Hughes around expanding options to treatment. Many of those people who were homeless and in the throes of addiction and living on the streets are now employed. Personal friends of mine, one of them, I don't know how comfortable she is being public, but one of them now comes to our ward. She will once we start going to a ward again the pandemic ends. But she comes to church with us. She comes to Sunday dinner with our family. And, you know, 2 years ago, she was a heroin addict who was homeless on the street. And now she has a job. She actually works in addiction recovery. She helps people who were like she used to be to get their lives sorted out and to get back. And she's giving back. She's giving back and she's making a difference. And when you've seen somebody's life change like that and know that I had a small part in making that possible and opening the door that she could then step through, that's a really good feeling. And I want to continue to give back. And I think there's more I can give.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about your family and then we'll finish this up. We'll do that in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Hey, this is Dan, the laptop man from PC Laptops. Friends, I know a lot of you guys and girls are working from home. So here's some tips for making sure your computer is ready for working at home, because if your computer fails, it's going to be really hard to get it fixed because of dwindling supply and parts. But we have parts right now, and we have a limited supply of new computers available for you. Make sure your computer is healthy and virus and malware free. Hackers are trying to infect people and stealing their information during these challenging times. We'll scan the health of your computer for viruses and malware, plus scan your hard drive, memory, and components to make sure you don't have any failing parts. You want to make sure you have strong antivirus and malware protection software as well. Just get into any PC Laptops and we'll check your hardware and your software and scan your computer for viruses for absolutely free. Just go to PCLaptops.com. At PC Laptops, we've been serving you for over 28 years, and we've got your back during these times of need. We're all in this together. So just go to PCLaptops.com and we'll get you taken care of.
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, you know, you may go to Washington, D.C., but as I understand it, your wife and family stay here in Utah. That seems impossible to me, and I think that there would be some that may throw shade and say, hey, you know what, why doesn't the family go? Or, you know, no success in life can make up for failure in the home, Ben. You know, all these things that we do to people that are never helpful. How are you able to manage and balance that?
Well, it does take a toll on the family, and my kids don't like it when I leave. They're happy when I come home, but we've found a balance. You know, there's no normal right now in the pandemic. But when times before, I would usually fly out on a Monday morning. I take I do my job helping kids get to school. Take my kids to school Monday morning, and then on my way to the airport, and then I get home Thursday night, usually in time for dinner and to put people to bed. So. I'm able to go to my kids' sports games on the weekends. I do miss the games during the week, and that's hard. But we try to stay in touch through FaceTime and telephone and that. And then when I'm home, it has to be quality time. We sacrificed quantity. We have to make it count with quality. And you know, when I'm home, I'm still also trying to be accessible to my constituents. So I work from our Utah office on Fridays, and I'm usually doing stuff on Saturday. And then Sunday's a really important day for us to have some family time. And we make it work. It's not ideal. I'll tell you. So we have four kids. We have 14-year-old twins and an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old. Our 9-year-old the other day told my wife that he hopes I lose my election so I don't have to leave town. So we're happy that he can't vote. So, you know, it does take a toll. But we try to make it work. And I know there are a lot of, every family is different and have things they have to juggle. And, you know, it's something unique that our family has to juggle, but we make it work.
Do you think that they get that the kids understand the scope of what you're doing?
I think our 14-year-old kids do. The twins do. They, the whole family came out to DC and spent about 10 days out there last summer. And they got to come. Kids can come onto the House floor. So my kids would come onto the House floor, and my daughter came with me once on a particular vote, and she would always ask what we're voting on and why. And she actually disagreed. I don't remember what the subject matter was, but she thought I should be voting yes when I was voting no. And so we had a really good conversation about it. And I think since then she gets it. She understands. The younger ones, I don't think do. They know that I leave every week, and they don't like that. But, you know, I think that the older ones, and hopefully our younger ones as they become older, will understand that it's an important job, and I'm able to help people and do some important things. And you know, we'll compensate for some of the sacrifices by having quality time when I am home.
Now, a question that I have always sort of mused about in my head is, are there like elders' quorums parties with like you and Senator Romney and Senator Lee, like all the men that and women that are within the Congress that you guys kind of get together and you're like, hey, maybe we aren't on the same side of the aisle, but you want to go get a scoop of ice cream? Is there any sort of interaction with all y'all?
No, I think there's a camaraderie, right? I mean, oftentimes we're on the same flight going out or coming back. And John Curtis and I know each other pretty well because he was mayor of Provo and I was mayor of Salt Lake County. So we have a pre-existing relationship. And our offices are like across the hall from each other. So we will oftentimes bump into each other in the halls of Congress and walk together as we're walking over to the Capitol. So we have a really good relationship. And I would say I have a good relationship with all of the members of the delegation. When I'm in DC, the job is so busy that you really don't have time to socialize. It's just, you know, I hit the ground at the airport at, I think it's 3:45, my flight lands, and I have a 4 o'clock meeting at my office. And so I just rush to the office and we go, and it's nonstop, you know, 8 a.m. to 10 or 11 p.m. every day until I jump on a flight and fly home. So we have a relationship, though. I think some of my colleagues who are empty nesters will stay in D.C. a little bit more. They still come back and forth, but they may stay for a weekend or whatnot, whereas I'm coming home. So I have to say I've never been to my ward in D.C. just because I've never been there on a Sunday. Hmm. I'm always home every weekend. So I don't know about the elders' quorum meetings.
I've always thought that would be an interesting thing. And obviously with you not living there, it doesn't apply. But those that live in Washington, D.C., like, all right, gospel doctrine today will be taught by Brother Romney and his, you know, home teaching companion.
Yeah. Well, I think I may be getting this wrong, but I think, who was it? Orrin Hatch and Harry Reid were in the same ward.
Yes.
And one of them was gospel doctrine. They home taught each other or something like that.
Is that right? I had heard that that Mormon urban myth as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's real, but my heart wants it to be real so bad.
All right. It's real. Okay. We believe it. It's true.
I think that's the 14th article, right?
Yeah.
There is so much that we could talk to you about. What do you think, and maybe one of our last questions that we have, talk about the responsibility that as members of the church that we have to be involved. Obviously, the church talks about this every time there's an election. You know, we invite you to go out and vote and to be, you know, civilly involved in all of these things. From your perspective, why is that so important?
I think it is the fourth mission of the church, right? To help the needy, right? And, you know, I don't want to be sanctimonious and say my way of doing it is the only way to do it. I think a healthy debate, a healthy disagreement in our political system is intended. We want, it makes our, I think, our decisions better. But I think being involved and giving back is part of our religious mission, our religious charge as members of the church. And that doesn't mean that everybody should be in politics, but, you know, I think we should look to provide service, to give back to your community in some way or another. So my sister, who's a therapist, my mom, who's a school teacher, do that professionally. My brother, who's an accountant, I don't know that he does that professionally, but he gives in other ways, right? So mm-hmm. we should always be looking to, in ways big and small, you know, looking out for the neighbor who is moving and showing up to help the elders' quorum move a neighbor or you know, going to and volunteering at the homeless shelter or, you know, that it's just part of our religious charge is to always look to give back. And the reason I think it's part of our religious charge is because of what it does to us as individuals. As we are giving, we learn about it ourselves. And it's really our charge from the Savior himself, who said, in as much as you do this unto the least of these, my brethren, you do it unto me. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's important for us to do as he did and to seek to give.
So let me ask you this, because I didn't. We kind of caught with your kids, and so I'm going back now a little bit. How is it with you and your wife, with you being gone? That essentially is like, hey, wife, be mom and dad. I'm out. I'll see you Thursday night. Is that taxing on you guys? Is it distance makes the heart grow fonder? How do you guys navigate that?
Well, she's amazing. that she makes it all work and keeps everything balanced and up in the, all the balls in the air. And she's amazing. So that's, I'm really lucky in that regard. Mm-hmm. And on top of it, on the weekend, she, you know, usually when I'm home, we have the, you know, the charity fundraiser for, I don't know, X organization or Y organization. And so date night for us is usually going to one of those, you know? And so I know. So she's really has a good attitude and that, she, you know, she's really supportive in doing that and walking in parades and throwing out candy and that. So I'm really lucky in that regard. It is a challenge. Yeah. I usually cook when I'm home. So, you know, I try to do my part, but my part is it's nowhere 50-50. It's, you know, during the week, she's juggling, running kids to school, to baseball practice, to basketball games. And that she's commented that one of the things that she likes about quarantine is she doesn't spend every evening driving all over the valley, getting people to and from their activities. Yeah. It's kind of nice to not do that. Right. Yeah. And so,
yeah, she's taken the chauffeur hat off and just been able to stay home.
Yeah.
It is interesting. Yeah. And sort of wrapping this up, I think that the world will be different. I think we will go back, you know, the economy will open up, all these services will open up. But I think where previously there wasn't the opportunity to work from home for some people, I think that people will discover that they actually liked it. And my hope is that that will mean that we have less cars on the road and that we're able to, you know, really focus, take this time that we've had to be able to be quarantined and focus on the things that really matter a little bit more, that when life is so busy, we didn't have a chance to really think about.
I think that's right. The other thing that I think has changed and that I hope we hold on to is just a profound sense of our own humanity and the humanity of others. So, you know, I ask when I talk to people on the phone or, you know, see people, which I don't do often.
From
but,
a socially,
you know,
responsible distance.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I traveled to DC and that I see people and I ask, how are you doing? And it's not just a passing comment. I really want to know, are you healthy? Is everybody okay? Is your family okay? You know, because a colleague of mine in Congress, his father-in-law died of the coronavirus, you know? And so you just feel this compassion. When I was sick and in the hospital, Kevin McCarthy, he's the Republican leader in the House. And look, he's in charge of making sure I lose my next election. Mm-hmm. But he called my wife and said, how is Ben doing? We're really worried about him. We want to, you know, and how are you doing? And that just this sense of, I know his job is to elect somebody else in my district. And that's how the system was created. It's maybe part of the system we don't like, but it's part of the system. But that we can simultaneously be competitive, whether it's in legislation or ideas, and also be compassionate. I think that's something that we have a renewed sense for. And it's not just members of Congress. I think it's neighbor to neighbor, coworker to coworker. And I hope we hold on to that too, is that compassion and care for one another, sense that we are all fragile and we all are dealing with things beneath the surface that you might not see on a Zoom call, whether it's health or financial hardship. And I think there's a greater sense of compassion that I hope we hold on to.
Yeah, I love that. Three questions before you go. First of all, do you have a calling right now? And if so, what is it?
I teach Elders Quorum right now.
Do you really?
Yeah.
How do you like that with the combination of the high priest and the Elders Quorum? Have you enjoyed that in your ward?
I have enjoyed it. Yeah, I've been a high priest. I was in a bishopric a while ago. So I guess I'm getting older now, but I was always like the young high priest. And I think it just brings the lessons. What I love about the church is we learn from the shared experiences of others. It's not just, you don't just go and it's not school where you memorize things out of a book, but we learn from the hardships and joys of others. And the combination of people from the age of 19 to 99, you know, the life experiences, I think it just adds to the diversity of life experiences that we can have. So I love that. Before I was elected to Congress, I was a ward clerk. And then just my schedule just didn't allow for that, being on the road constantly and that. So now teach Elders Quorum. I love it. And I do like the combination. I think, you know, just so much more to learn from each other.
If you could pick a calling, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
My wife teaches gospel doctrine. I think that's I like that. Mm-hmm. both, you know, then you have men and women in the classroom. It's even more broad. And gospel doctrine is interesting. It's, I think, even more substantive. You know, some of the, you are studying the scriptures. And I think gospel doctrine is interesting. I like teaching. We both like teaching. So probably that. And then I used to always aspire to be the ward librarian.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the politician in me, that your job is to just hang out and talk to people,
yeah,
you know, skip class and hang out and talk to people. So that seems like the ideal job that I've never had.
Well, I'll put in a word.
Okay.
And then finally, and interpret this question however you would like. But the question is what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of the faith, unquestionably, is the associations we have, the instant relationships that we have. So I think of an experience when I went to law school in New York City, and I remember it was kind of scary as a boy from Utah. My wife and I, we loaded up a moving van with all of our possessions and drove across the country to New York.
Wow.
And it's scary. It's a big city. You know, we were 24, I think, at the time, and away from family. We showed up and there were 10 people there helping to move in. The elders' quorum was there to move us in.
Wow.
And those people are lifelong friends now. And it's just, I love the fact that you have these relationships that we develop that I would never get otherwise. When am I going to associate with a 105-year-old woman on a regular basis and consider her a friend?
Right.
Or the right-wing conservative who gives me a hard time every Sunday about being a Democrat. And it's in a loving way. It's not in a judgmental way. It's in a loving way that those relationships that the world, I think, is becoming increasingly segregated, that on social media, you associate with the people who think like you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it used to be at least geographically, you had relationships with your neighbors and that, but even now our relationships are driven by our interests. And so we are self-selecting into the people who we associate with are like us. And the church, for me, breaks that mold. And I associate with people who are different than me. And I think I'm better for it. And, you know, socioeconomically different, ethnically different, age-wise, different status of life. It's just, I think my life is richer because I have people who I have over for dinner. You know, like outside of the church, when would you invite some random person over for a Sunday dinner?
Right.
And it's just common. It's just we do that. And so I think the one thing we do better than any organization in the world is community and relationships. That it is just add water. You know, you are a member of the ward, you have an instant relationship, and we care for each other. And we do that better than, I think, than anybody.
Well, we hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you will be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat, it's sure to be neat.